This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments Podcast for the week of August 11th, 2014. This podcast is presented by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated in cooperation with your State Society of CPAs. Any use of this podcast or other materials related to this podcast without the express written consent of Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs is prohibited. This podcast is copyright 2014 Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be going over some of the developments that occurred in the past week on federal tax matters. We'll start out with the case of Jackson versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-160. That deals with a taxpayer who is trying to claim a deduction for using a recreational vehicle to sell insurance. Mr. Jackson had attended RV rallies socially for many years, and what he determined was that he also sold insurance. And he found that the policies that were offered for auto coverage really didn't apply to high-end RVs, and he saw an opportunity to market policies at these RV rallies. So even though he had gone socially for many years, he now began to use his recreational vehicle as part of his marketing routine to sell the insurance. And as at least one other person who attended the rally said in testifying in the case, Mr. Jackson became a bit of a pest about selling insurance at these rallies. The IRS, however, protested, claiming that he should get no deduction for expenses related to this RV. And the IRS claimed two different justifications. The tax court did not buy the first one. The IRS claimed Mr. Jackson had become involved in RV rallies for social purposes, and his primary purpose remained social, was their view. Therefore, as a primarily social device, that is the RV, there should be no deduction allowed for any business use of that RV. The tax court disagreed. It found that you could convert what was previously a personal social activity to a business activity if the facts were correct, and the court found in this case that the facts were correct. However, the court ran into another issue. The RV qualifies as a residence, and because it qualifies as a residence, and it became one of the taxpayer's residences, the taxpayer had to deal with the rules at Section 280 Cap A. Those are the home office rules. And Mr. Jackson could not show that you had exclusive use of any part of the RV for business purposes. Because of that, even though the court found that a significant portion of the costs really were business related, the reality was that Congress had said you get nothing unless you follow the 280 Cap A rules. Not following those rules, no deduction was allowed to Mr. Jackson for any of the expenses related to the recreational vehicle. A Chief Counsel Advice 2014-32015 deals with an issue about when you form a new corporation. And this was a problem with the rules under Section 382. Those rules were meant to stop entities from being able to traffic in net operating losses. That is, previously, before these rules existed many years ago, the idea was you could go find a nice burnt-out lost corporation, acquire those shares, and then start a new business inside of there using up the net operating loss. Section 382 is meant to stop this. The issue in this case was, though, that we had a business that was being started up. And in its first couple of years, there were five separate stock issuances given during that time frame. Now, the mechanical rules of Section 382 are such that every time there's a change, we look to see if there's been a 50% ownership change by looking back in the prior 3 years. The problem becomes we have to have something to measure change from. If we measure change in this case from the first issuance of stock, then the fifth issuance that we got in this list of issued stock would have been an ownership change. And since there was a loss in the prior year, there would have been a loss coming forward that created a problem. However, the taxpayer claimed that really there were the initial three stock issuances really were just part of initial capitalization, and in fact they occurred before the entity actually began operating in business. The memo concludes that that position is supportable under the code, but it did not conclude that the facts have been established yet in this case to make it clear that in fact those first three really could be combined. But the memo is an interesting memo to look at just to see the issues about how you would handle starting up a new entity and the risks. If you have multiple people or multiple groups coming in at different times At what point do we start applying the 382 rules? Useful memo if you have that situation. We have another pair of PLRs here where taxpayers were refused a rollover of an IRA. In the first case, private letter ruling 2014-32032, in this case, the taxpayer had money in an IRA. He wanted to put this money into a limited partnership that he was involved in. The custodian of the IRA refused to accept that limited partnership as an asset of the IRA. That would, by the way, be true of many custodians. You're not going to find many custodians who are going to want to hold privately held partnership interest from a privately held partnership, one that's not a publicly traded entity, inside the IRA. We had this come up a couple weeks ago, you may remember, in the case of Dabney versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-108, where the taxpayer tried to force Charles Schwab to take on an asset Schwab was not going to take on. In this case, the taxpayer went to his CPA and asked the CPA, what could we do about this? Well, the CPA wasn't specialized in the area. That at least is the terms of the letter ruling. Interestingly enough, that may give some clue as to where our problem is going to be here at the end, but we'll keep going. So the CPA went and he consulted people inside the wealth management firm that he worked with, and the wealth management firm went and consulted their own outside CPA firm. And after doing all this consultation, the CPA went back to the individual and stated, well, what you can do is just title the partnership interest in the name of the IRA. Don't worry about the fact the custodian won't hold it. Well, unfortunately, as Dabney shows us, that's not really good advice. And about 2 years after the CPA gave this advice, the CPA discovered this wasn't good advice. And he contacted the taxpayer and said, taxpayer, we have a problem that didn't work for a rollover, so we need to see if we can get the IRS to grant us late rollover relief. Now, the taxpayer had a letter from the CPA, and the taxpayer's letter from the CPA stated that the CPA had given him this bum advice. Normally, in these cases, having a financial advisor admit to giving bad advice is enough to allow for the IRS to allow a 60-day rollover extension. But in this case, the IRS denied that relief. And there may be a reason we can take from what the IRS tells us why they did it as to maybe what was going on. The private letter ruling states that the taxpayer chose to use proceeds from the IRA to fund a business venture rather than attempt to roll the proceeds over into an IRA account for retirement purposes, and for this reason, they did not grant an extra rollover period. Now, the use of that term and the fact we're told the CPA wasn't really specialized in this area, which makes us wonder, well, what's this area? IRAs aren't really a heavy specialty, shall we say, suggests that what we might have here is a transaction where a taxpayer was attempting, as the IRS kind of states here in their letter, to use their IRA funds to fund a startup business. And what would not be terribly surprising to discover is a taxpayer wanted to maintain the funds in there. They had found a custodian who would handle this sort of self-directed IRA. And if that was the case, then that might explain why the IRS was not going to be willing to grant the 60-day extension. IRS has not been happy with that structure. Last year we had two cases, Ellis versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2013-245, and Peek versus Commissioner 140 TC number 12, which dealt with situations like that where the IRS successfully used the prohibited transaction rules against IRAs to essentially blow up the IRA, treating the whole amount as being distributed to the taxpayer. Presuming the IRS may have felt, the taxpayer in this case was trying the same transaction, the IRS may simply have decided that they were not going to authorize a late rollover, only to have that convert into what would become a prohibited transaction. The service's position very clearly is you're not supposed to use IRA funds to start up a business, and it would appear that this might have been the problem in this case. A more traditional denial was found in Private Letter Ruling 2014-32030. In this case, the taxpayer took money from one financial institution and apparently took her time about rolling it into another institution, getting it in well more than 60 days later. Now, she claimed ignorance, which, by the way, doesn't work as a reason. I didn't know what I was doing. But she claims she was ignorant and she relied on the first financial institution as her financial advisor to tell her about the 60-day rule. The IRS objected to this view on two points. Number one, the taxpayer produced no evidence that the original financial institution had agreed to be her advisor. Rather, they simply held an account in the IRS's view. Number two, the IRS stated even if they agree to be the advisor, an advisor is under no obligation, in this case, who holds IRA funds is under no obligation to inform a taxpayer about the 60-day rule unless the advisor takes that on explicitly on their own. Having shown neither that they were her advisor nor that they had taken on responsibility for advising her on rollovers, the IRS disallowed and would not grant an extension of the 60-day rollover period in private letter ruling 2014-32030. The next case, which is a little bit interesting, deals with issues related to aircraft. And this is the case of Williams versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-158. Now, Mr. Williams is interesting. He ran training seminars. And he ran these training seminars, and as part of this, he acquired an airplane. Actually, his father had been involved in the seminar business, and he had been chartering planes back when to fly to these locations because he didn't like using commercial airliners. It turns out Mr. Williams is also a pilot, which is part of the reason why we have this situation arising. After his father passed away and he was running these seminars now on his own, he looked into acquiring an aircraft again to go back so he could fly himself to these seminars. And he discovered that while it didn't make sense financially for the company to have an airplane, because it really didn't make financial sense, just like it didn't make financial sense back in the past to have chartered the planes, he did find, though, that he could acquire a plane and then lease it out for most of the time, with those lease payments covering the cost, which would give him access to a plane from time to time. So he acquired this plane, leased it out. He also did research about the passive activity rules with aircraft. And he discovered that basically there were two ways he could be active in this. Well, there's a couple things. Number one, obviously, if this was part of the activity of his seminar business, which he spent more than 500 hours in, then he would be materially participating. But even if that was not the case, as long as he could show that he spent more than 100 hours in the activity, and no other person spent more time, that also would qualify it as material participation for purposes of a short-term leasing arrangement. And all parties agreed that these planes were leased out, or at least to a certain extent. Let's say all parties didn't agree, but the court decided didn't have to decide if they met the short-term leasing arrangement. He leased the planes out, and he had them used by flight training schools. Two different flight training schools were involved, and they would basically, when one of their students needed a plane, the student would lease the plane from Mr. Williams. And in fact, what he really did was he made the plane available to the school, which would then turn around and provide the plane and collect the lease payments. He had an agreement with each of the schools that he used. He used two different schools. One failed, and so he went with a new one after that. But in both cases, the agreement held that the schools were to ensure that no individual, no employee, would spend more than 100 hours working with the plane. Now, that would not count the actual training time when somebody else was leasing the plane from him, but as far as for leasing the plane or doing work for him as an agent to get the plane leased, nobody's been more than 100 hours. Well, Mr. Williams first claimed that this was properly grouped with his training seminars. The tax court found that was not the case. It found that, in fact, it was overwhelmingly, the planes were used overwhelmingly on the leasing side far more than for the business, and in fact, Mr. Williams had to testify that at times he would go out and lease a plane on his own to fly because he'd get more money leaving it on the leasing activity. So the court found that you could not group that with the seminars. On the 100 hours, Mr. Williams claimed, well, he shouldn't have to prove that nobody spent more time than he did. The court said, sorry, you're trying to claim a benefit. You've got to prove it. Number two, the court also didn't really pay much attention to that agreement saying no more than 100 hours. There were two problems. Number one, Mr. Williams did not have sufficient evidence of his own that he spent more than 100 hours involved in dealing with the plane. Number two, that almost doesn't matter because the court clearly indicated that they believed that the other entities that were leasing it clearly had to spend more than that amount of time involved in the activity. And despite his agreement of no more than 100 hours, without documenting that they had actually complied with that agreement, he couldn't show that he met the requirements for material participation. As such, the loss on the leasing activity was treated as a passive activity for these purposes. The next case we're going to consider is the case of the estate of Adele versus Commissioner. And this case really deals with personal goodwill as well as estate valuation issues. In this particular case, we had original value of the business was valued at $9.3 million on the estate tax return. Now, it turns out the way this business was structured, the goodwill was actually very much with the son. The son had negotiated the deals. The son had all the connections. The son had no employment agreement. Well, after the son inherited the business, there became a dispute with his sisters. And back and forth went on, and eventually they went back and claimed that there was no value in the entity or that they were valueless. So he filed a claim for refund now for the estate, claiming less. The IRS came in and claimed, nope, sorry, the value is well above that level. What happened in this case was the court went back and said, you know what? We think actually the original valuation of this estate makes the most sense. The court did find the son truly owned the goodwill, and the IRS came in with a much higher figure, but they presumed the son would agree to work for only $1 million a year. The court said that makes no sense. He can control a much more profitable operation, and he has total control of it. But the court also rejected a view that there was an agreement with the not-for-profit that they were doing the work for that said they would get no more than a reasonable level of compensation and that the level they'd been taking was unreasonable, so it wouldn't remain as profitable. The court held that, look, there's no reason to believe that a buyer would not get the same deal and have the same provision effectively ignored that had been ignored up to now, so we're going to stick with the $9.3 million. Finally, a quick issue to note for you. Treasury Decision 9687 was issued. That issued the final whistleblower regulations. A taxpayer who is attempting to turn in another taxpayer and collect the reward. Couple of changes here. First thing is state and local government officials and members of boards now qualify as whistleblowers. They can get the money. And the IRS changed the way now they're going to monitor the effect of information given on later returns. So if, for instance, the information given reduces a net operating loss, so it creates no current tax amount for the IRS, but it gives the IRS money in the future, the IRS will pay out the whistleblower claim based on the collections in the future. Claimants file Form 211, and they provide information required in the regulations. If you have a taxpayer looking at becoming a whistleblower, you want to take a look at the regulations found in Treasury Decision 9687. This has been the Nichols Patrick's Tax Update for the week of August the 11th. Please be sure and check in with us next week as we'll take a look at the new developments in the coming week.